Blanchard, who was the commanding officer of the base at that time, called me into his office and he said, I've got some information I want to give you and I want you to put out a press release on this material. The only thing that I felt at ease with was the fact that we had in our possession a flying saucer and we shipped it on basically to the next higher command. I think that a cover-up was designed so that they could say it was a Mogul balloon or some kind of balloon. Within my own feeling, I think that it was something from outer space.
It's Walter Hout on our bumper introducing this part, Don Schmidt, and you knew him quite well.
I'd like to think so. If not spending time together, we would talk over the phone on a regular basis, and many times, more times than not, we wouldn't even bring up the subject. And I'd like to think that's what good friends do, that it isn't just my always.
It wasn't a one-note Johnny friendship. And Glenn Dennis put that UFO museum together single-handedly almost. What was the, you know, he obviously didn't tell the story until that, we call it a deathbed confession, but it actually was
3 years ago.
Yeah, right, right. But it was supposed to be released later, the affidavit. Why do you think he did that? Had the UFO museum to begin with, if he wanted to keep it a secret.
Well, it was one of the things that we had even discussed with Walter back around 1990. Our concern that as the story would become, you know, more noteworthy, that the outside opportunists would attempt to commercialize the incident. And Walter agreed with us. We were becoming more concerned about the historic preservation of the event and what type of a facility could, you know, house that commemoration, that information, become a repository for all the witnesses involved. And the museum certainly did and continues to serve that purpose. As Walter, you know, obviously becoming the president, becoming the director, and becoming certainly the greatest ambassador of the museum up until the time of his death. He, and as I describe in the book, as we both, as Tom and I describe in the book, we would like to believe that his former commanding officer, Butch Blanchard, would look down and say, well, you didn't break your oath, as I asked you not to, but you at least are preserving the memory.
And, you know, I had the good fortune of meeting him a couple of times later in life, naturally. But I can understand that he had this loyalty to Blanchard that was even above probably his loyalty to the nation and to his service.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more, Jerry. He would often describe his closeness to Blanchard almost like a nephew, uncle. He didn't want to go so far as to say father's son. But there are a lot of nephews who are very close to their uncles and vice versa. And I think the best example is that when Blanchard died at the Pentagon, that it wasn't simply just a phone call informing him of his death, but they sent a courier from Washington directly to Walter's home with that sad news. So I guess, yeah, that's as close as one could actually get. That's family. And I think, as you described, his loyalty to his country was only superseded by his loyalty to his friend and family member in many regards, Colonel Blanchard, who would, you know, go on to become a four-star general. so much for his making such...
Was there any examples where Blanchard might have weakened a little and wanted to talk?
Well, there were times that even his own family, his daughter described that every time they would bring it up, and to her it was almost as though her father was brainwashed to some degree, because every time it would come up within family circles, she would describe how her father would go into almost this trance, and he would just stare out beyond everybody in the room, and he would always respond the same way, by saying, "The Russians have some amazing thing." Well, okay, but his wife Anne, his widow Anne, who still lives, still living, says that her husband would always say that, well, at first we thought it was Russian, because nobody could identify it.
Uh-huh.
But then after everything was tested and analyzed, there was no doubt that the materials were not from here. Now, you wouldn't ever, there's no family member that mentions any descriptions of bodies or crewmen, connected to the incident. But clearly, Blanche, I think another good story was there was a former mayor of Roswell. His name was Brainerd. And they were having a reunion in Roswell in the mid-60s, just before Blanchard actually died, for all the former base commanders at the base. And they were all sitting at the same table. And somebody brought up the 47 incident. And what actually became of all that stuff. And according to the former mayor, all Blanchard would say was, "That was the damnedest stuff." That was almost 20 years after the incident. And instead of just laughing it off and, oh, you know, yeah, everybody made such a big to-do over that weather balloon. But after 20 years, he still, "That was the damnedest stuff."
So there's a lot of admission by a lot of the players that this weather balloon story and all the other things really is nothing but BS. I guess really they're all just conflicted. They'd like to talk, but they've got that oath.
Well, it's like the, I think it's been used in the past as an example, just the thought that as Clark Kent, you know, you're Superman. You can't tell anybody. You just love to blurt it out to the world. You know, "Hey, everybody, I'm Superman." So, just imagine.
Being a journalist and you're a writer, I'd have to write it down someplace. But I guess none of that surfaced anyplace.
Well, but we still have hope. So talk to family members, many of them who describe, yeah, my father or my husband, you know, he had a piece. And I think a good example there is O.W. Pappy Henderson.
Famous name.
Who even showed a piece to a good dentist friend of his, Dr. John Kromschroeder, in the late 70s. And it was an actual piece of the memory material. And how, obviously, the powers that be were keeping an eye on some of these remaining witnesses, and who should arrive at Henderson's door, you know, within short of a courier from Washington. And "I'm here to retrieve, you know, a piece of top secret material you have in your possession." And that was the end of that.
Well, I wonder where that piece went.
We even had his widow, Sappho, you know, go through a lot of old boxes, and when they had moved Hawaii, just seeing the transfer of all of their personal possessions, we had her keep an eye out if something should strike her as extraordinary. So let's just say that we don't believe it's possible that someone still has a souvenir of sorts in their possession.
What about the things that are edited out in your book simply because you can't just publish pages forever? Got to do some sort of editing.
Well, one of the stories that was dropped was, even the people up in Corona, where Mac Brazel, you know, supervised the Foster Ranch at that time where the Freefield was located. And we describe how that fall at prom, at the Corona High School, some of the kids were passing around a piece of the memory material for their amusement. Curious to all the people who were there, and they knew where it was from. They knew it was definitely, you know, a piece of the real material from the actual crash. And there, too, what became of it.
Well, I know one time I met you at the museum, you and Tom, and I was talking to you about your search for the memory material, and you were quite, that was several years ago, you were quite hopeful you had found a piece, but evidently not.
And that was, involved the police officer, Ferd Illinois, and his story to us of having visited his son in Albuquerque, and he just thought, well, as long as I'm this close, I'm going to go pay a visit down to the museum. And he described how he was in one of the local diners and mentioning out loud, being, you know, from out east and still interested in the story, and an elderly couple describing their involvement, and the husband saying, I'm going to just go and pick something up and I'll be back in a short time. And according to the police officer, he turns about a half hour later, he opens up a box, and he's got a piece of this material. And they ask the police officer, go ahead, try to poke your steak knife through it, try to cut it. Do whatever you can, see what it, you know, effect it has. And it's, again, a piece of the actual memory material.
Do you have any idea who the elderly couple was?
Well, I've met with the police officer. He actually, you know, drove about 100 miles to meet with me in the company of two of his deputies to vouch for his story. And he just flatly refused to divulge the name. But the plan was that he was going to go back down another trip to visit with his son and attempt to meet with them and see if it would be all right. Well, since that time, he's left the police force down in Rockford. He's changed his name. He only had 2 years left before retirement, and he leaves the force, changes his name, and I can't get him to talk to me again. So it's rather bizarre.
So it appears that maybe there was some intervention by something or somebody.
And I think partly because he made the mistake going public, a local newspaper wrote up the story of what had happened, and then we meet with him, and since then he's gone into hiding. So a bizarre series of circumstances, but every so often I think about trying to track him down again. But
well, maybe he's listening and he'll get in touch with us.
Very possible. I know we know he's interested in the subject.
We have 15 more minutes to go, and Don, when we come back, I want to talk about people who insert themselves in the story, and anything that you'd like to bring out as well, and. there's some things I want to talk to you about members of the media back in 47 and what they're doing today, and exactly how many of these, you know, there was a local newspaper, local radio stations, there were people around. How come we don't hear from a lot of people in the media? I would think some of the media people would all be there knocking on the door telling us about these things.
I couldn't agree more.
We'll be right back. The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime. Anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at ShopJerryPippin.com. Don Schmidt, this book is doing very well on Amazon.
Well, as well as Barnes & Noble and eBay. And
in your local bookstore.
Yes.
So a lot of people say, yeah, they wrote this because they want to make a lot of money. Like that's a bad deal. But you wrote it, and I've talked to you and Tom separately and together, and both of you are in this at this point to get the truth out, I think.
Exactly. Research certainly comes with a heavy price. Both financially and personally, anyone who's involved in this field, family life, social life, often takes a back seat.
Sure, I mean, every time your wife wants to go someplace, you go down to Roswell.
Well, that's it, exactly. I think that before I married even, I was spending 100 days a year on the road, because I wasn't just going down to New Mexico. Wherever witnesses took us, wherever we had to track these people down, I don't think there's a state throughout the Union that we haven't made trips to.
You know, the listeners may not grasp how this becomes an obsession with a reporter or a journalist. When you're onto a story and you almost have the key but you don't have it, I don't know, I can't speak for you, Don, but it's a driving thing.
Well, it becomes certainly a commitment.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't drop
it. You just can't drop it because it comes down to... And as I often pose to members of the media, those who have been, you know, willing accomplices to the cover-up, for those who have gone out of their way to, you know, discredit and smear the reputation of witnesses, the investigators involved, and so on, all in the name of covering this up, if those people are wrong, who is guilty of the greater, you know, grievance?
Good point.
These people who have had the power to bring this out, to force the hand of the government, and for all these years we've always relied on the press as serving as our public watchdogs. If they don't protect us from, you know, the government becoming too powerful, taking, you know, as far as over too much control, taking away too many of our rights, if the press doesn't defend us and provide us with the truth, then who's going to do that?
And, you know, unfortunately, in today's modern world, the press has let us down too many times. And I say that as a member of the press, but it's really very, very disturbing. What's happening these days?
It is, and I think a lot of it has to do with certainly the internet, the 24-hour news station.
And there's many, many reasons, and I've had, and many of them are censoring things, not realizing they're even censoring it, simply because basically, Don, we in the media are getting paid a little more than we deserve, and you don't want to give that up. And managers and editors and program directors are not bashful, I can tell you from first experience, about, well, Jerry, you don't really want to follow this up because, you know, so-and-so advertises with us, and they probably wouldn't like it.
Well, so, yeah, as you mentioned, yes, certainly the commercial aspects of the profession, but also, sadly, investigative journalism has become a lost art.
It's almost
because
like people don't know how to ask questions.
Don't know how to ask questions. They don't know how to really follow up on a particular investigation. Because it is so time-consuming that the news has become so instantaneous that if I can't start, you know, on a story the first thing in the morning, if I can't wrap it up by that evening, it's not worth my time and effort.
Well, and the people you work for say, well, what have you been doing? No, you're right about that. It takes months sometimes or years. Let's just talk about some of the people in the media. There were at least one daily newspaper there, right?
There were two, Daily Record and the Roswell Dispatch.
Were you able to find any reporters or editors or anything that were willing to talk to you later? I mean, it seems to me as a reporter, I'd go out there and try to find out what's happening.
At that time, they did. And I could throw out a whole bunch of names, even as far as the different radio stations. you had the Frank Joyces.
Frank has been around on the internet here a little while, and he was aware at one of the radio stations.
KGFL, and you had Johnny McFoyle, and you had John Roberts, and you had Art McQuitty. I mean, these are all people who were affiliated either with the newspapers or the radio.
You're a younger guy than I am, and I certainly was an adult in 47. I'm not that old. But I remember in the late 50s and early 60s as a cub reporter, a small reporter at a radio station, I was allowed to do some amazing things on sites. Remember one time bank robbers were shooting at highway patrolmen, and I was laying right there next to them, talking to them, interviewing them. I mean, things like that don't happen now. You have the press conference, and everybody's kept away from the media. But back in 47... I don't think they were as serious about keeping you away from the story.
No, but let's just quickly go through the scenario of even the timeline of events with Mac Brazel, the rancher, coming into town, reporting this to the sheriff's office, and the very first person beyond the sheriff that he speaks to is a member of the press. It's none other than Frank Joyce at KGFL, who happens to call up the sheriff's office to get some late scuttle for his next newscast. So Joyce's boss, Walt Whitmore Sr., obviously wants the exclusive. So after Brazel has led the two intelligence officers, Major Marcel and CIC Captain Sheridan Cabot, back to the ranch, Whitmore sends somebody up to grab Brazel from his ranch. And they hide him out at his home that late evening of July 7th.
Well, now, see, that sounds like a movie, but I can tell you the media would have behaved that way, especially back in those days. I would probably do that today.
They grabbed the source. They grabbed the very person who came in with the story and some of the debris, and they put him on a wire recorder at that time at Whitmore's home. Judd Roberts even described to his grandson before he passed away that Brazel indeed did talk about the bodies up at the ranch. But the military, obviously, in their attempts to contain and squelch the whole story, they're frantic to find Brazel, because Brazel's no longer up at the ranch. So who do they immediately suspect? Well, obviously, the members of the press. And they find him at Whitmore's home. And that's where they grabbed him. That's where they then detained him, you know, after even the balloon explanation. And they confiscated that wire recording. And we know that the FCC was enlisted to contact the members of the press, threatening them with loss of their licenses.
And back in those days, I want to tell you, that was before appeals and court cases. Every radio station operator feared the FCC.
They certainly did, because they said you're going to lose your license.
Usually you lost.
You lost your license. And they even enlisted, they had Senator Dennis Chavez from New Mexico also call and reinforce that threat and say, it's out of my hands. If you don't obey what they, you know, told you to do, I can't help you. And as we started the program, and that's where Sheriff George Wilcox then was the follow-up man to then go to their homes and tell them, you better do as you're told, because they mean business. So that's how the press was not only enlisted, but how they were then used to basically, you know, shut down the entire story. And it worked. The military was God back at that time, especially coming off of World War II.
Oh, sure.
And they didn't have to tell you twice.
I understand that. We only have about 5 minutes left. Can you kind of give me a thumbnail sketch of what do you think happened that night with the crash? I mean, how many crash scenes, et cetera, et cetera?
I am almost 100% convinced that there was a craft, as we would, by today's standards, call a UFO, a craft of unknown origin, something beyond our technology, something beyond our human, you know, existence here on this planet, that for whatever reason was caught up in a severe lightning storm. And whether it was struck by lightning or an internal malfunction caused it to explode, raining debris on a site about 65 miles northwest of Roswell, the bodies were
you say a number, you think three?
At the secondary body site, about 2.5 miles from the debris field, Brazel used the plural term of bodies. So at a minimum, certainly of two at that site. Either sucked out, drawn out by the...
That we haven't talked about over the years is actually there could have been more, I guess.
No, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Because there was another body site. So along that trajectory line, that either through the percussion, the depressurization of the object, the bodies, a couple were sucked, were drawn out to that location, still on the Brazel Ranch, and then a pod, a capsule.
You and Roswell explained it better than anything that we've talked about. It's like the control room or whatever is insulated and it turns into an escape pod, for more or less.
Right. I mean, we've had that type of technology ourselves for many years.
Yeah, right.
To suggest that something even beyond our own planet wouldn't have designed such a capsule for such a catastrophic event. And it continued on for another 30 miles before impacting about 40 miles north of Roswell. And that's where the remains of the crew and this pod would have been recovered. So we're talking three separate locations.
Where do you think the live ET was?
At the impact site, 40 miles north of town. From all accounts, it was at the site just north of town. And then hence the reason for the involvement of, you know, the sheriff, the fire department, all within that county, because this is within Chavez County, where Roswell was the county seat. So this idea that the sheriff and the fire department would have been involved in a separate county just would not wash. They would not have jurisdiction in another county.
Now, I have a couple of minutes left. Something you want to get out to the public here that we haven't talked about?
Well, I think some of the gossip, some of the talk about Walter writing the statement for posthumous release strictly for the financial benefit of the museum. And I think you observed this yourself, Jerry, at this recent festival. There was absolutely no display, nothing even suggesting such a sealed statement at the museum, where they could have truly capitalized on his admissions, his affidavit. The Sci-Fi Channel, in conjunction with NBC just a year ago, had offered to present Walter's statement on network TV, and the family declined at that time. So this notion that these people are always looking to financially capitalize on what happened, it basically still comes back to they want the truth to come out. They want their fathers, their husbands, their wives in some of the cases to be vindicated, to be exonerated as far as for what they knew to be the truth after now 60 years. And after all this time, the government is still denying them, denying all of us that truth.
Maybe there's someone listening that has some information. Is there a good way to get a hold of you?
Well, certainly, even at any of our email addresses. In my case, it's Schmidt, Don, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, Don, 47, at AOL.com.
Right, and we have that on the website.
And even our own website, www.RoswellInvestigator.com.
And of course, they can get in contact with us, and we'll get in contact with you, too, as well.
And we always respect and honor confidentiality.
I have not heard anyone tell me personally that you guys have violated their confidence. I've heard the third and fourth party stories of people who have an axe to grind, but I've heard nothing but that you guys are ethical.
Well, thank you, Jerry, and we certainly strive to maintain that level of professionalism, and as I was saying, we are looking for the information, not to publicize or capitalize on someone's name or reputation. It's the information that is the impetus for this entire event. And it's the very thing that continues to grow and, you know, raise this incident to the level of something truly extraordinary. The names behind it are just the names, but it's the details of the story, of the testimony, that, as we were describing earlier, is the very thing that would make us victorious in any court of law.
Don, I feel you're not through with this story.
By no means. And in fact, even while we were in Roswell Festival, we were working on this. We were interviewing people. We were behind the scenes still, you know, tracking. And we have research trips planned for the fall. And interviews are still underway as we speak. And if you're still out there, we will make every effort, every attempt to find you, and hopefully get you to go on the record.
Good luck, Don, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
We will. Thank you.